Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. Today we present the final installment of a four-part reading of the Epic of Gilgamesh, the most ancient of stories, a popular story told throughout the ancient Mediterranean world that would influence stories to come, stories like the Iliad and Odyssey, and even the stories in the Bible. Today we'll read books 10 and 11 of the Epic. The number of these books correspond with the number of the tablets that were found in the middle of the 19th century in Iraq. There are actually 12 tablets altogether, but the 12th tablet does not follow the narrative arc presented in these first 11. What you get in the 12th tablet is suddenly Enkidu is once again alive, and Gilgamesh loses a musical instrument in the world of the dead, in the underworld, and Enkidu goes to retrieve it for him, and then Enkidu gives an account of what the underworld, what the world of the dead, was like. And it's mostly a terrible place. However, the moral of this 12th tablet of the Epic of Gilgamesh is basically Enkidu tells Gilgamesh, the more sons you have, the happier you will be in the afterlife. So this does certainly come from a patriotic world. So many versions of the Epic of Gilgamesh exclude this tablet, Tablet 12, as does Stephen Mitchell's version, and that is the version we are reading this week. And now, without further delay, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Book 10. At the edge of the ocean, the tavern keeper Shiduri was sitting. Her face was veiled. Her golden pot stand and brewing vat stood at her side. As Gilgamesh came toward her, worn out, his heart full of anguish, she thought, this desperate man must be a murderer. Why else is he heading straight toward me? She rushed into her tavern, locked the door, then climbed to the roof. Gilgamesh heard the noise. He looked up and saw her standing there, staring at him. Why did you lock yourself in? He shouted. I want to enter now. If you don't let me, I will smash your locks and break down your door. Shiduri answered, you seem so wild that I locked my door and climbed to the roof. Tell me your name now. Where are you going? Gilgamesh is my name, he said. I am the king of great walled Uruk. I am the man who killed Humbaba in the cedar forest. I am the man who triumphed over the bull of heaven. Shiduri said, why are your cheeks so hollow and your features so ravaged? Why is your face frost chilled and burnt by the desert sun? Why is there so much grief in your heart? Why are you worn out and ready to collapse, like someone who has been on a long, hard journey? Gilgamesh said, shouldn't my cheeks be hollow? Shouldn't my face be ravaged, frost-chilled and burnt by the desert sun? Shouldn't my heart be filled with grief? Shouldn't I be worn out and ready to collapse? My friend, my brother, whom I love so dearly, who accompanied me through every danger, Enkidu, my brother, whom I love so dearly, who accompanied me through every danger. The fate of mankind has overwhelmed him. For 6 days I would not let him be buried, thinking, if my grief is violent enough, perhaps he will come back to life again. For 6 days and 7 nights I mourned him, until a maggot fell out of his nose. Then I was frightened. I was terrified by death, and I set out to roam the wilderness. I cannot bear what happened to my friend. I cannot bear what happened to Enkidu. So I roamed the wilderness in my grief. How can my mind have any rest? My beloved friend has turned into clay. My beloved Enkidu has turned into clay. And won't I too lie down in dirt like him and never rise again? Shiduri said, Gilgamesh, where are you roaming? You will never find the eternal life that you seek. When the gods created mankind, they also created death, and they held back eternal life for themselves alone. Humans are born, they live, then they die. This is the order that the gods have decreed. But until the end comes, enjoy your life. Spend it in happiness, not despair. Savor your food. Make each of your days a delight. Bathe and anoint yourself. Wear bright clothes that are sparkling clean. Let music and dancing fill your house. Love the child who holds you by the hand, and give your wife pleasure in your embrace. This is the best way for a man to live. That's straight eat, drink, and be merry philosophy that you will find in Ecclesiastes and also the words of Jesus said, eat, drink, and be merry. That is the best way for people to live. Back to the story. Gilgamesh cried out, "What are you saying, tavern keeper? My heart is sick for my friend who died. What can your words mean when my heart is sick for Enkidu, who died? Show me the road to Utnapishtim. I will cross the vast ocean if I can. If not, I will roam the wilderness in my grief." Shaduri said, "Never has there been a path across the vast ocean, nor has there ever been any human who was able to cross it. Only brave Shamash, the sun god, as he climbs the sky, can cross the vast ocean. Who else can do it? The crossing is harsh, the danger is great, and midway lie the waters of death, whose touch kills instantly. Even if you manage to sail that distance, what will you do when you reach the waters of death? The one man who can help you is Urshanabi, Ushnapitam's boatman. He is trimming prime branches down in the forest, and he has the stone men with him. Go to him. Ask. If he says yes, you can cross the vast ocean. If he says no, you will have to turn back." At these words, Gilgamesh gripped his axe, drew his knife, and crept down toward them. When he was close, he fell upon them like an arrow. His battle cry rang through the forest. Urshanabi saw the bright knife, saw the axe flash, and he stood there, dazed. Fear gripped the stone men who crewed the boat. Gilgamesh smashed them to pieces, then threw them into the sea. They sank in the water. Gilgamesh came back and stood before him. Urshanabi stared, and then he said, "Who are you? Tell me, what is your name?" "I am Urshanabi, the servant of Utnapishtim, the distant one." "Gilgamesh is my name," he answered. "I am the king of Great Wild Uruk. I have traveled here across the high mountains. I have traveled here on the hidden road through the underworld, where the sun comes forth. Show me the way to Utnapishtim." Urshanabi said, "Your own hands have prevented the crossing. Since in your fury you have smashed the stone men who crewed my boat and could not be injured by the waters of death. But don't despair. There is one more way we can cross the vast ocean. Take your axe. Cut down 300 punting poles, each 100 feet long. Strip them. Make grips. And bring them to me. I will wait for you here." Gilgamesh went deep into the forest. He cut down 300 punting poles, each 100 feet long. He stripped them, made grips, and brought them to Urshanabi, the boatman. They boarded the boat and sailed away. They sailed without stopping for 3 days and nights, a 6 weeks' journey for ordinary men, until they reached the waters of death. Urshanabi said, "Now be careful. Take up the first pole. Push us forward, and do not touch the waters of death. When you come to the end of the first pole, drop it. Take up a second and a third one until you come to the end of the 300th pole, and the waters of death are well behind us." When all 300 poles had been used, Gilgamesh took Urshanabi's robe. He held it as a sail, with both arms extended, and the little boat moved onto the shore. Alone on the shore stood Utnapishtim, wondering as he watched the men approach. "Where are the stone men who crew the boat? Why is there a stranger on board? I have never seen him. Who can he be?" Gilgamesh landed. When he saw the old man, he said to him, "Tell me, where can I find Utnapishtim, who joined the assembly of the gods and was granted eternal life?" Utnapishtim said, "Why are your cheeks so hollow? Why is your face so ravaged? Frost-chilled, burnt by the desert sun? Why is there so much grief in your heart? Why are you worn out, ready to collapse? like someone who has been on a long, hard journey. Gilgamesh said, "Shouldn't my cheeks be hollow? Shouldn't my face be ravaged, frost-chilled and burnt by the desert sun? Shouldn't my heart be filled with grief? Shouldn't I be worn out and ready to collapse? My friend, my brother, whom I love so dearly, who accompanied me through every danger, Enkidu, my brother, whom I love so dearly, who accompanied me through every danger, the fate of mankind has overwhelmed him. For 6 days I would not let him be buried, thinking, if my grief is violent enough, perhaps he'll come back to life again. For 6 days and 7 nights I mourned him, until a maggot fell out of his nose. Then I was frightened. I was terrified by death, and I set out to roam the wilderness. I cannot bear what happened to my friend. I cannot bear what happened to Enkidu. So I roamed the wilderness in my grief. How can my mind have any rest? My beloved friend has turned into clay. My beloved Enkidu has turned into clay. And won't I too lie down in dirt like him and never arise again? That is why I must find Utnapishtim, who men call the Distant One. I must ask him how he managed to overcome death. I have wandered the world, climbed the most treacherous mountains, crossed deserts, sailed the vast ocean, and sweet sleep has rarely softened my face. I have worn myself out through ceaseless striving. I have filled my muscles with pain and anguish. I have killed bear, lion, hyena, leopard, tiger, deer, antelope. I have eaten their meat and wrapped their rough skins around me. And what in the end have I achieved? When I reached Shiduri, the tavern keeper, I was filthy, exhausted, heartsick. Now let the gate of sorrow be closed behind me, and let it be sealed shut with tar and pitch." Utnapishtim said, "Gilgamesh, why prolong your grief? Have you ever paused to compare your own blessed lot with the fool's? You were made from the flesh of both gods and humans. The gods have lavished you with their gifts as though they were your fathers and mothers. From your birth they assigned you a throne. They told you to rule over men. To the fool they gave beer dregs instead of butter, stale crust instead of bread that is fit for gods, rags instead of magnificent garments, instead of a wide-fringed belt, an old rope, and a frantic, senseless, dissatisfied mind. Can't you see how fortunate you are? You have worn out yourself ceaselessly striving. You have filled your muscles with pain and anguish. And what have you achieved to bring yourself one day nearer to the end of your days? At night, the moon travels across the sky. The gods of heaven stay awake and watch us, unsleeping, undying. This is the way the world is established from ancient times. Yes, the gods took Enkidu's life, but man's life is short. At any moment it can be snapped, like a reed in a canebrake. The handsome young man, the lovely young woman, in their prime, death comes and drags them away. Though no one has seen death's face or heard death's voice, suddenly, savagely, death destroys us, all of us, old, young. And yet we build houses, make contracts. Brothers divide their inheritance. Conflicts occur, as though this human life lasted forever. The river rises, flows over its banks, and carries us all away. Like mayflies floating downstream, they stare at the sun. Then all at once, there is nothing. The sleeper and the dead, how alike they are. Yet the sleeper wakes up and opens his eyes, while no one returns from death. And who can know when the last of his days will come? When the gods assemble, they decide your fate. They establish both life and death for you. But the time of death, they do not reveal." Book 11. Gilgamesh said to Utnapishtim, "I imagine that you would look like a god, but you look like me. You are not any different. I intended to fight you. Yet now that I stand before you, now that I see who you are, I can't fight. Something is holding me back. Tell me, how is it that you, a mortal, overcame death and joined the assembly of the gods and were granted eternal life? Utnapishtim said, I will tell you a mystery, a secret of the gods. You know Shurippak, that ancient city on the Euphrates. I lived there once. I was once its king, a long time ago, when the great gods decided to send the flood. Five gods decided, and they took an oath to keep the plan secret. Anu, their father, the counselor Enlil, and Anugi, the sheriff. Ea also, the cleverest of gods, had taken the oath. But I had heard him whisper the secret to the reed fence around my house. Reed fence, listen to my words. King of Shurippak, quickly, quickly, tear down your house and build a great ship. Leave your possessions. Save your life. The ship must be square, so that its lengths equal its width. Build a roof over it, just as the great deep is covered by the earth. Then gather and take aboard the ship examples of every living thing. I understood Ea's words, and I said, My lord, I will obey your command, exactly as you have spoken. But what shall I say when people ask me why am I building such a ship? Ea said, Tell them that Enlil hates you, that you can no longer live in their city or walk on the earth, which belongs to Enlil, that it is your fate to go down into the great deep and live with Ea your lord, and that Ea will rain abundance upon them. They will have all they want and more. I laid out the structure. I drafted the plans. At first glow of dawn, everyone gathered. Carpenters grabbed their saws and axes. Reed workers brought their flattening stones. Rope makers brought their ropes. And children carried the tar. The poor helped too, however they could. Some carried timber. Some hammered nails. Some cut wood. By the end of the fifth day, the hole had been built. The decks were an acre large, the side 200 feet. I built 6 decks, so that the ship's height was divided in 7. I divided each deck into 9 compartments, drove water plugs in all the holes, brought aboard spars and other equipment, and 3,000 gallons of tar poured into the furnace, and 3,000 gallons of pitch poured out. The bucket carriers brought 3,000 gallons of oil. 1,000 were used for the caulking. 2,000 were left, which the boatmen stored. Each day I slaughtered bulls for my workmen. Each day I slaughtered sheep. I gave them barrels of beer and ale and wine, and they drank it like river water. When all our work on the ship was finished, we feasted as though it was New Year's Day. At sunrise I handed out oil for ritual. By sunset the ship was ready. The launching was difficult. We rolled her on logs down to the river and eased her in until 2/3 was underwater. I loaded onto everything precious that I owned, all my silver and gold, all my family, all my kinfolk, all the animals, wild and tame, craftsmen and artisans of every kind. Then Shamash announced that the time had come. Enter the ship now. Seal the hatch. I gazed at the sky. It was terrifying. I entered the ship. The Pazur Amuri, the shipwright, the man who sealed the hatch. I gave my palace with all its contents. At first glow of dawn, an immense black cloud rose on the horizon and crossed the sky. Inside it, the storm god, Adad, was thundering, while Shulat and Hanish, 12 gods of destruction, went first, tearing through mountains and valleys. Nergal, the god of pestilence, ripped out the dam of the great deep. Ninurta opened the floodgates of heaven. The infernal gods blazed and set the whole land on fire. A deadly silence spread through the sky, and what had been bright now turned to darkness. The land was shattered like clay pot. all day, ceaselessly. The storm winds blew, the rain fell, and then the flood burst forth, overwhelming the people like war. No one could see through the rain. It fell harder and harder, so thick that you couldn't see your own hand before your eyes. Even the gods were afraid. The water rose higher and higher until the gods flew to Anu's palace in the highest heaven. But Anu had shut the gates. The gods cowered by the palace wall like dogs. Sweet-voiced Aruru, mother of men, screamed out like a woman in childbirth, "If only that day had never been, when I spoke up for evil in the council of the gods. How could I have agreed to destroy my children by sending the great flood upon them? I have given birth to human race only to see them fill the ocean like fish." The other gods were lamenting with her. They sat and listened to her and wept. Their lips were parched, crusted with scabs. For 6 days and 7 nights, the storm demolished the earth. On the 7th day, the downpour stopped. The ocean grew calm. No land could be seen, just water on all sides, as flat as a roof. There was no life at all. The human race had turned into clay. I opened a hatch, and the blessed sunlight streamed upon me. I fell to my knees, and I wept. When I got up, I looked around. A coastline appeared, a half mile away. On Mount Nimush, the ship ran aground. The mountain held it and would not release it. For 6 days and 7 nights, the mountain would not release it. On the 7th day, I brought out a dove and I set it free. The dove flew off, then flew back to the ship because there was no place to land. I waited. Then I brought out a swallow and I set it free. The swallow flew off, then flew back to the ship because there was no place to land. I waited. Then I brought out a raven and I set it free. The raven flew off, and because the water had receded, it found a branch. It sat there. It ate. It flew off. It never returned. When the waters had dried up and land appeared, I set free the animals I had taken. I slaughtered a sheep on the mountaintop. I offered it to the gods. I arranged 2 rows of 7 ritual vases. I burned reeds, cedar, and myrtle branches. The gods smelled the fragrance. They smelled the sweet fragrance and clustered around the offerings like flies. When Aruru came, she held up in the air her necklace of lapis lazuli, Anu's gift when their love was new. "I swear by the precious ornament that never will I forget these days. Let all the gods come to the sacrifice, except for Enlil, because he recklessly sent the great flood and destroyed my children." Then Enlil arrived. When he saw the ship, he was angry. He raged at the other gods. "Who helped these humans escape? Wasn't the flood supposed to destroy them all?" Ninurta answered, "Who else but Ea, the clever of us, could devise such a thing?" Ea said to the counselor Enlil, "You, the wisest and bravest of the gods, how did it happen that you so recklessly sent the great flood to destroy mankind? It is right to punish the sinner for his sins, to punish the criminal for his crime, but be merciful. Do not allow all men to die because of the sins of some. Instead of a flood, you should have sent lions to decimate the human race, or wolves, or a famine, or a deadly plague. As for my taking the solemn oath, I didn't reveal the secrets of the gods. I only whispered it to a fence, and Utnapishtim appeared to hear it. Now you must decide what his fate will be." Then Enlil boarded. He took out my hand. He led me out. Then he led out my wife. He had us kneel down in front of him. He touched our foreheads, and standing between us, he blessed us. "Hear me, you gods. Until now, Utnapishtim was a mortal man. But from now on, he and his wife shall be like gods, like us. They shall live forever at the source of the rivers, far away." Then they brought us to his distant place at the source of the rivers, and here is where we live. Now then, Gilgamesh, who will assemble the gods for your sake? Who will convince them to grant you the eternal life that you seek? How would they know that you even deserve it? First pass this test. Just stay awake for 7 days. Prevail against sleep, and perhaps you will prevail against death. So Gilgamesh sat down against a wall to begin the test. The moment he sat down, sleep swirled over him like a fog. Utnapishtim said to his wife, "Look at this fellow. He wanted to live forever, but the very moment he sat down, he went to sleep." His wife said, "Touch him on the shoulder. Wake him. Let him depart and go back safely to his own land, by the gate he came through." Utnapishtim said, "All men are liars. When he wakes up, watch how he tries to deceive us. So bake a loaf for each day he sleeps. Put them in a row beside him, and make a mark on the wall for every loaf." She baked the loaves and put them beside him. She made a mark for each day he slept. The first loaf was rock hard. The second loaf was dried out like leather. The third had shrunk. The fourth had a whitish covering. The fifth was spotted with mold. The sixth was stale. The seventh loaf was still on the coals when he reached out and touched him. Gilgamesh woke with a start and said, "I was almost falling asleep when I felt your touch." Utnapishtim said, "Look down, friend. Count these loaves that my wife baked and put here while you sat sleeping. The first one, rock hard, was baked 7 days ago. This leathery one, baked 6 days ago, and so on for all the rest of the days of the week you sat here sleeping. Look, they are marked on the wall behind you." Gilgamesh cried out, "What shall I do? Where shall I go? Death has caught me. It lurks in my bedroom. And everywhere I look, and everywhere I turn, there is only death." Utnapishtim said to the boatman, "This is the last time, Ur-Shanabi, that you are allowed to cross the vast ocean and reach these shores. As for this man, he is filthy and tired. His hair is matted. Animal skins have obscured his beauty. Bring him to the tub and wash out his hair. Take off his animal skin and let the waves of the ocean carry it away. Moisten his body with sweet-smelling oil. Bind his hair in a bright new headband. Dress him in fine robes fit for a king until he comes to the end of his journey. Let his robes be spotless as though they were new." He brought him to the tub. He washed out his hair. He took off his animal skin and let the waves of the ocean carry it away. He moistened his body with sweet-smelling oil. He bound his hair in a bright new headband. He dressed him in fine robes fit for a king. Then Gilgamesh and Ur-Shanabi boarded, pushed off, and the little boat began to move away from the shore. But the wife of Utnapishtim said, "Wait, this man came a very long way. He endured many hardships to get here. Won't you give him something for his journey home?" When he heard this, Gilgamesh turned the boat around, and he brought it back to the shore. Utnapishtim said, "Gilgamesh, you came a very long way. You endured many hardships to get here. Now I will give you something for your journey home, a mystery, a secret of the gods. There is a small spiny bush that grows in the waters of the great deep. It has sharp spikes that will prick your fingers like a rose thorn. If you find this plant, bring it to the surface. You will have found the secret of youth." Gilgamesh dug a pit on the shore that led down into the great deep. He tied two heavy stones to his feet. They pulled him downward into the water's depths. He found the plant. He grasped it. It tore his fingers. They bled. He cut off the stones. His body shot up to the surface, and the waves cast him back, gasping, onto the shore. Gilgamesh said to Ur-Shanabi, "Come here. Look at this marvelous plant, the antidote to the fear of death. With it, we return to the youth we once had. I will take it to Uruk. I will test its power by seeing what happens when an old man eats it. If that succeeds, I will eat some myself and become a carefree young man again." At 400 miles, they stopped to eat. At 1,000 miles, they pitched their camp. Gilgamesh saw a pond of cool water. He left the plant on the ground to bathe. A snake smelled its fragrance. Stealthily, it crawled up and carried the plant away. As it disappeared, it cast off its skin. When Gilgamesh saw what the snake had done, he sat down and wept. He said to the boatman, "What shall I do? All my hardships have been for nothing. Oh, Urshanabi, was it for this that my hands have labored? Was it for this that I gave my heart's blood? I have gained no benefit for myself, but have lost the marvelous plant to a reptile. I plucked it from its depths, and how could I ever manage to find that place again? And our little boat, we left it on the shore." At 400 miles, they stopped to eat. At 1,000 miles, they pitched their camp. When at last they arrived, Gilgamesh said to Urshanabi, "This is the great wall of Uruk, which no city on earth can equal. See how its ramparts gleam like copper in the sun. Climb the stone staircase, more ancient than the mind can imagine. Approach the Iana temple, sacred to Ishtar, a temple that no king has equaled in size or beauty. Walk on the wall of Uruk, follow its course around the city. Inspect its mighty foundations. Examine its brickwork, how masterfully it was built. Observe the land it encloses, the palm trees, the gardens, the orchards, the glorious palaces and temples, the shops and marketplaces, the houses, the public squares." And so it ends as it begins, with a description of the great walled city of Uruk. And that completes our reading of the Epic of Gilgamesh.